Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's our 14th year on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host, and we'll be talking with two great guests who are also authors and advanced cicerones. So let's go around the room. You guys introduce yourselves. Start with Mandy.
Hi, I'm Mandy Neglich. I am the author of How to Taste, which is either about to come out or has just come out when you guys are listening to this. I am also a food and beverage journalist, a cocktail judge, and certified in several different tasting mediums. So lots to talk about with taste.
Well, I'm so happy about this book and really looking forward to talking with you. And Em?
I'm Em Sutter. I'm the founder and cartoonist behind Pints and Panels, which is a website where you can learn all about beer in a cartoony format. I'm also an advanced cicerone, like you said, an author of two books and an international beer judge. I also co-host the All About Beer podcast.
Great. Well, let's spotlight each of you and just talk a little bit about how you got, you know, where you are and the books that you wrote and everything. So, Mandy, this is a big deal. How to Taste. I met you a couple years ago and you were on the advanced cicerone track. Tell me about the book and the process. And, you know, was it a discovery process for you by writing the book?
Yeah, I think actually when we met, I was on the Master Cicerone track at the time, which as you can see, I'm still an advanced Cicerone. So shifted a little bit. But yeah, a lot of that practice going into both advanced and Master Cicerone is focused on tasting. So doing practice tasting taught me a lot about not just tasting beer, but tasting everything. And as I got curious about different mediums, things like cheese, honey, cider, I started talking to other professionals who were professional tasters. And one of them, my friend Olivia Haver, who's down at the farm at Doe Creek making cheese, said, "Oh, that's so cool that you're a Cicerone. I could never do that." But she's a certified cheese professional. And I was like, "I think you certainly could. Like with your palate, if you learned about a little bit about beer," she knows about fermentation already. And it really started to show me that there's so many professionals, there's so many people who are interested in taste, but really once you train your palate, there's a ton of crossover between specialties. And it doesn't need to be a book about tasting whiskey, a book about tasting wine. It can really be about tasting everything. And that kind of set me on the journey. So I have Olivia to thank for sure.
Wow, that's great. It's really cool. It says How to Taste, a Guide to Discovering Flavor and Savoring Life. So like, what's an intro tasting thing that people might go through? I mean, is it just learning how to savor, you know, that really well-made piece of bread you had? Or, you know, what are some of the conversations that you have with people about your book?
Yeah, so the book starts with kind of the science of our senses. So just scientifically, what's happening when we're tasting? How are messages moving from your nose and your mouth into your brain? How does your environment affect what you're tasting? You know, loud music at a restaurant really is going to have an impact on what you're tasting. As Em and I know, you know, doing a test-taking situation for tasting really lets you focus. So it moves into that. It moves into a complete tasting method in the middle of the book that goes from every single sniff you'll take, every sip, swirl, taste on anything from honey to olive oil. And then kind of ends with some fun ways. Once you've trained yourself as a taster, how does that change your life? How could you travel better for taste? How can you think about memory and taste? How can you relate your health to the status of your taste. So really kind of takes you on a full journey from inside your mouth to training your mouth to taking it out into the world.
Oh, that's great. And Em, a little bit more about you, how you went from being that amazing cartoonist to having a book and being an advanced Cicerone.
Yeah, so I just always loved beer, and I've been drawing since I was 4. I went to art school. I graduated in 2011 from the Center for Cartoon Studies, which is a cartooning program in Vermont. It is a real place. And then went into the beer world, worked at a couple of breweries, worked at a beer store. And actually, when the pandemic hit, Pints and Panels, I had a little time to focus on, all right, what do I want to do with my website? Because I actually, Pints and Panels was around since 2010. It was a beer review site. And my first book, Beers for Everyone, came out in 2017. And so during the early lockdown part of the pandemic, I started really leaning towards the education side. And since everyone was learning and trying to, you know, do better for the most part and also stay inside and stay healthy, Pints and Panels took off a little. And now that's where I wholly divert all my focus to is visual beer education. The website is free, 100% free to use. So you can find information about everything from how to clean draft lines to styles to silly infographics. Today is beers paired with characters from The Office that my sister who's in Office. Yeah, it was my sister. I came up with the pairings. My sister, Abby, is a real Office super fan. Actually, my husband, the reading at her wedding was a scene from The Office. my husband read. Well, we were on the beach because they got married.
Are they Jim and Pam? And, what roles do they play?
They're probably Jim and Pam. Well, Pam, a lot of people don't like Pam. but everyone likes my sister. She's very nice. So, and I like my sister a lot. We're family. So, she was very helpful in here are the IPA choices I'm thinking. And she was like, oh, I don't know about that. And then her husband, Eddie, chimed in and it's fun to, now that Pints and Panels is growing slightly, I really like collaborating with a lot of people from Central and South America to do Argentinian food pairings. I'm actually learning a lot because I've never been to Argentina. And so there are beer styles they have and food pairings, obviously they have that I've never had. So it's been really collaborative to team up with people to go, hey, how would you pair with this and why? And so it's been a lot of fun. And now, my second book came out last year and, you know, just lots of little things, lots of little projects. I just started writing for Forbes.com actually today was my first article. So there's a lot.
Congrats.
There's a lot. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And they're letting me use my art, which I was amazed. I was like, can I use my art when I write for you? And they were like, we love it. Perfect.
Yeah. They better let you use it. Come on.
I know. And I was like, I own it too. Right. Cause that's very important to me when you're an artist. You got to protect your stuff. And so it's just, yeah, it's been fun. And I've known Mandy for a few years now. We studied for the Master Cicerone together. Obviously, we both aren't Master Cicerones, but that doesn't mean we both aren't incredibly smart and, you know, well-intentioned, good beer tasters. And I'm really, really excited. I just pre-ordered Mandy's book this morning. And I cannot
wait.
We
have some book events coming down the road, too, that we're going to do together.
Yeah, so we get to work together, which is very, very fun.
Yes. And we're rooting for all the future female Master Cicerones, which we know are out there studying right now, too.
Yes.
We're not accompanying them on the study trail anymore, but in spirit behind them, rooting them on.
We're there
for
them.
Well, for the book launch, I mean, this will probably be out right before June 27th, but most people will listen to it over the next couple of weeks. What are some of the first book launch events? Are they in person or are they part of a tasting, you know, program?
Yes. Yeah, I'm excited because I have a lot of friends who are authors. I've actually co-authored a cookbook, and I know it's pretty rough book events that are kind of just reading or talking based. So all of my book events are based with tasting. Everyone will have something to taste at everything we do. The kickoff is going to be at Archestratus. We're doing kind of like a cheese board tasting, you know, pairing many flavors together and talking about that. And then we're having a launch party at Talea in Cobble Hill.
Good for you.
On the 29th. So that's going to be fun. Obviously that one's a beer tasting and a little more party focused. And then, yeah, I'm touring all over the East Coast. So we're doing events at Allagash, Sam Adams, some places out on Cape Cod this summer. We're going out to Montauk. So all the events are on howtotastebook.com, but bouncing all over, tasting things. We're going to do an oyster tasting out in Montauk. So, you know, like I said, the book applies to everything. So
let's take your book and talk about those tastings. So it's like oyster, yeah. Even though it's almost too far into the summer, it's oysters. And so what are you going to do related to your book and oyster tasting? You have some pairings. Are you going to do exercises? Let's get us interested in the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, chapter 4 is based on a 6-step tasting method that you can follow with everything, including oysters, which starts, you know, looking at your setting as well as the thing that you're tasting. So, you know, if we have 3 different kinds of oysters lined up, they will appear 3 different ways. The setting we're in Montauk, it would definitely be different than, you know, if we were in LA or something like that. So that's like kind of your C step, taking in. The book goes into each sense and what you're kind of taking in your environment. Next, I mean, Em can chime in here too. As training for Master Cicerones and current advanced Cicerones, we learned many different sniffing techniques, from really short explosive sniffs to going all the way through the retronasal sniff, which is kind of using the back of your nose to sniff. So we would walk through all of those. There's other sniffs that we picked up from interviewing some cheese tasters and an olive oil taster too. So kind of going through all the ways to use your nose, going into the 3 different kinds of tastes that professional tasters typically do, which is your match taste, seeing if it's your aroma matches the flavor of your oyster, which this medium, it typically doesn't. You typically don't get a lot of that sweetness and kind of, I guess, meatiness of an oyster in the aroma. You're going to get a lot more brine and sea character. So that's your first taste. Your second taste is for mouthfeel, which obviously oysters, depending on firmness, sweetness, you know, how creamy they are, they will all 3 be different. And then moving into the last taste, which is your aftertaste. And it's unpleasant and considered a bad characteristic if you have a very long aftertaste, especially a metallic one in an oyster. So we'll see, hopefully. I don't think we'll have any of those out on Montauk, but we'll be able to test through for all of those. So yeah, moving through just like the full tasting method with all of those. And then also talking about different things that people might not realize about oysters. You know, there's tewa in something like wine, but then there's mewa in anything that's seafood based, because basically instead of a blood, oysters use seawater to use their circulatory system. So any of the water around them is flavoring their delicious little bodies for us. So just facts like that, which you can find throughout the book, and use that chapter 4 tasting method on anything.
Wow. I bet you have questions for Mandy about the book.
Oh my gosh. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. Em's going to be in town for the Talea book party. So I'm going to write a long inscription in her book.
Oh, shucks. I remember to bring it too, because it said it was going to be here right the day that it was released. And then, we're actually going to do an event at RJ Julia Bookstore in their Middletown location in Connecticut, because I'm up in Connecticut, on July 12th. And we're going to do a beer and chocolate pairing, or Mandy's going to do a beer and chocolate pairing or chocolate tasting. And I'm going to hang out and wave to people and listen to her expertise. Because it's really fascinating about, my focus is solely beer. You know, people ask me a lot like, oh, do you do wine or spirits? And I was like, I wish I did, because then I'd be wealthier. that's aside the point, but beer, you know, beer is my whole focus and my passion. So watching someone like Mandy, who has her hands in all sorts of different, be it spirits and wine and tasting and oysters and chocolate and all sorts of stuff, it's really fascinating to see that the skills you learn when you drink and sniff and try beer can be pushed to almost any food, you know, or drink, and you learn a lot. So it's I'm really, really excited about, how long did the book take you to write, Mandy?
That's a good question. I think from the time I like actually had the book deal and started writing, it really only took about a year, because so much of it was just expanding on what I'd been spending my whole life learning. I think second books, you can probably speak to this. I feel like second books take a lot longer to physically write because you have to start with a new idea, where this is kind of like something I've been thinking about for a long time. It just had to actually get it down on paper. But yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, yeah.
It's really well written. I mean, I'm enjoying it. Like, there's references to James Beard Award-winning chefs, and it sounds like you had a lot of fun writing this book.
Yeah, it was cool. I got to kind of, you know, pick some idols that I'm like, if I could get them in the book, that would be really cool. One of my favorite episodes of Top Chef is it's actually a Top Chef Masters where they blindfold all of these Michelin star chefs and James Beard Award-winning chefs and make them, you know, do a completely blind tasting, and some of them get way far off. And I was lucky for the book to get to talk to Rick Bayless about his experience calling, I believe he called a mango guava or something like that, and hoisin sauce ranch, like really had some rough experiences on that. So it was fun to get his point of view on blind tasting, and then talk to some master somms who obviously, you know, they could nail some mango tasting blind.
Let's talk about blind tasting, because it is really hard. I mean, I've been to some parties where they've had like the black glass, and I know that Steal This Beer, that's one of their signatures. What happens when you can't see what you're drinking?
That's a good question. I mean, I think sometimes it actually helps you a little bit more. You know, sometimes we see something that looks very dark, and it actually doesn't have those dark, roasty flavors, but we kind of almost put them in the glass with our minds, just because you see something dark, you're expecting ash, burnt chocolate, and sometimes it's not there. So sometimes it can be helpful. Other times with like things like red and white wine, it's actually a lot harder to tell those two things apart than people expect. So the black glass can be quite frustrating and definitely eye-opening for people who consider themselves, you know, top wine tasters. It's an exercise that Rick actually does with his entire staff, as far as getting them to taste out of a black glass, just to remind them that their palates aren't, you know, as incredible as they might think.
I remember one time years ago when I was just getting started, it was like kind of wine 101, and we had a blind tasting, and I just guessed that this New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc was New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, because at the time they always said, oh, if it smells like grapefruit, then it's New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And that was the only time I ever nailed something.
Nice.
But do you have to have the cheats like that? I mean, because I've done it, and I'm like, sometimes when it's, if I'm totally blind and I'm drinking something and I don't know if it's been poured from a tap or a bottle, you know, it could be a wine, a spirit, or beer, and you wouldn't know right away. Is that just me?
No, I think that's definitely true, and something I've been doing recently with friends, you know, who are professionals from all different areas of the food industry. We've been doing like blind tasting things like vermouths and triple secs, just to kind of get a rating on how sweet or floral we all think they are. And it's amazing. Yeah, when you blind something, how your opinion changes. I always thought I was a Contro girl, but I rated Grand Marnier very high and actually less sweet. So that was shocking to me. But Em, when you were practicing for, you know, Advanced and Master Cicerone, how did you go into blind tasting? Did you have cheats that you memorized at all, or just repetition?
It was a lot of repetition. I had a really great beer store near my house, like brown bag everything, so I couldn't see everything. Or like, well, you can, the one of the cheats is sometimes when you're doing it by yourself. This before the pandemic, my husband used to work at night, and so I'd be alone when, like, obviously I wasn't going to drink it, like, you know, when he was awake, because it was, you know, 10 in the morning. So sometimes you could cheat by the feel of the, you would know by the feel of the can or the bottle what it was. So it was really hard to try to make sure that when you were drinking, you know, there's certain flavor. I'm trying to think of any, like, color is a huge giveaway.
Right.
Huge, huge giveaway. And then you can kind of, if you know hop variety aromas and flavor, that's also kind of it. And then yeast. Like, if you're getting white pepper phenol, chances are it's a Belgian. Or if you're getting a lot of like ester, like heavy esters, and there's some like caramel malt and there's a floral or tea like hoppiness, it's probably English. So once you know those kind of help. But at the same time, like, I got a lot of them wrong, most of them wrong.
There's also like, I feel like just like we said from repetition, like you can put Sierra Nevada Pale Ale just like in the same room as me and I can smell it and know that it's Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. Same thing with Chimay Red. That was the only one that I called on the test. Like, I was like, this is definitely a Chimay Red. I know it. And it was.
But yeah, I don't think I could ever taste a beer or like, no, maybe no, I don't. I'm also not great with like hops where people are like, oh, I really get the citra in this. And I'm like, do you though? Cause I like, not that I'm a better taster than anyone else. I'm not. But I really certainly can't pick out hop varieties as well as others. So everyone has their, you know, how many people are blind to diacetyl or other off flavors. A lot of people have certain struggles, or just, you know, blinds that they will never get. And that's totally fine.
Well, and I think when it comes to calling a hop, that's really tough because it's basically the same bouquet of, say, 15 compounds that are just in different, you know, intensities and concentrations. So if you get a weird batch of Citra, it's not going to be so different than some of the other newer hops, you know. It's kind of crazy. I mean, that's like, yeah, writing this book, coming down to it, it's like the esters that we recognize in beer are the same ones that are in whiskey, the same ones that are in honey. Even some of the same ones, like some of the terpenes and stuff in olive oil are the same flavors we're getting in hops. So it's like being able to describe something and name an aroma and then actually calling a hop, I feel like are two. One seems much more possible to me than the other.
Yeah. Hey, Mandy, you really go, you cover a lot of things. You talk about how would you, what would a dog know in the airport who's detecting, you know, things that shouldn't be in your bags to coffee. And what was something new that you learned from writing this book?
Yeah, I think so. Bill Simpson, who is definitely, I would say, mine as well as many people who are focused on tasting beers, tasting mentor, interviewing him for this book was very eye-opening to me because he really explained to me that when he's training us to taste, he trains us like we're sniffer dogs. Like he's training us to identify a compound, not to like get esoteric and, you know, think about where the beer we're smelling fits into the wider mosaic of beers in the world. He really is trying to train us just like those dogs were trained. They're sniffing for one compound. In the case now, it's usually things in meats. People were really worried about pig diseases. So all the beagles are trained to smell out meat in people's suitcases. And he trained us the exact same way. And even though I trained with him for, you know, a couple of years, I never really realized that was his philosophy. I was just following him blindly to train my nose. So that was definitely something interesting.
That's really cool. Yeah, I think what I was saying about the cheats is that I feel like anytime I've tried to do it, I've tried to look for an easy way to identify something like a wine or a beer if I'm tasting blind. But I've never really thought about the compounds themselves behind it.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been lucky to work with some spirits brands, like some rum brands and things. And getting to know rum, if you know whiskey and bourbon, you can actually get into aged rums quite quickly. It's they're definitely analogous because what are they picking up their flavors from? I mean, so much of it is from the aging in the barrels and those are the same flavor compounds. You know, you might have a slightly different distillate, but really once you know how to taste one, it's not too hard to cross over into the other. So,
you know, when you've reached your levels like advanced Cicerone and, you know, you can, let's say you're a master taster, What are the next steps? I mean, do you enjoy tasting? Are you always analyzing? Do you still get new experiences?
Yeah, I think it's something that we put too much stress on. Like people are always like, oh, can you turn it off? Like, and I'm not constantly analyzing things for faults. You know, I think thinking about tasting makes it way more enjoyable. There's a passage in there I'm writing about. I kind of told this omakase chef, like, I would love to try something new. My husband and I are huge sushi fans. Like, we've tried a lot, if there's anything. And he gives us crab brain, which I would not say is the most pleasant flavor memory I have. It was very, it was like ground up walnut shell and like old seaweed that was in a barn or something kind of flavor.
Yeah.
But I was like, yeah, there you go. He totally gave me a new flavor experience that I have never tried. I don't know that I will try it again. But I kind of think once you start thinking about collecting flavors like that, or just being more thoughtful about what you're tasting, it kind of opens the world up a lot. Like, you know, if someone looked out their window and said like, oh, the sky looks green, like you would send them to the hospital. But if someone drank red wine and said, oh, this tastes like Diet Coke to me, you'd kind of be like, oh, okay. I don't really know. Like, we don't put the same emphasis on being able to describe what we taste and smell as like what we see or music that we hear. I think it should be given a little more love for the tasting world.
That's a great point. And I'm really enjoying, I'm just starting to browse through the book, but this is a book that I'm going to read cover to cover completely. And, so M, for you, you know, with your studies and everything, I mean, how deep do you go with smell and senses? I mean, cause you're also an entertainer with what you do with Pints and Panels.
I try. Yeah. I do a lot of off flavor, visual beer education. So that's really helpful because some people just don't like, they're blind to it, or the science of it can really confuse your senses. Like when I was learning about diacetyl, which is that movie theater, butter, popcorn, toffee, caramel, butterscotch, flavor that some beers get, I like really struggled with the science of it until I drew it. And then I was like, oh, okay, I see where this does this. And then the like reactions and whatnot and how it's created. And so I tried to do, there's off flavor training for almost, visual beer education sheets for every master, because the master cicerone, you got to learn a lot of different off flavors. Like, I don't even remember how many there are. I want to say there's like 20. Mandy, do you remember?
I was going to say 27, I think.
Yeah, I think 25 or 30. It was a lot. And so, yeah, what is damascenone? What is, you know, how does that show up in beers, and what does it smell and taste like? I still, for the life of me, can't get damascenone.
I always think it tastes like tinned cranberry juice from spring break. That's like...
that's a really fun part about beer tasting, or any tasting in general, is the nostalgia and the memory.
But then isn't that very personal? Like if you say...
It can be, yeah, of course.
Tinned cranberry juice from spring break, does that mean it's been sitting in your pack all day? And then what brand is it?
Yeah, it's like frat house cranberry.
It's not like Lakewood that's like so tart that it kills your acidophilus or something.
It's the it's definitely that like tin where you like poke it on the side and it's ocean spray. Mm-hmm. I get really esoteric and weird with my tasting notes, so much so that when I took the Master Cicerone exam, I got knocked because they were like, you're relying too much on your own personal experiences, and this doesn't help anyone.
Well,
and so
that's
like,
my criticism often of some people's descriptors. Like there's a whole generation that was talking about Jolly Ranchers and beer, and I've never had Jolly Rancher, and I don't identify it with anything. And I always want people to go a little beyond that.
It is yeah. So when I do, I have to remember. So actually, this is very recently, but the majority of my Instagram followers are outside of America. So they're not American.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And that's the majority. So when I now make posts, I need to remember when I talk about foods, like what's a graham cracker? You know, like if I live somewhere else, like I don't know it. And then same thing with when I travel different places and they talk, I've judged in Australia and I got a beer that tasted like a Tootsie Roll Pop. And I tried to explain that to them and they all just looked at me like I was there. I was like, oh, that's a food you don't. Oh, okay. So I can't rely on stuff. So when nostalgia is really cool for your own, and also tasting is subjective. So like Mandy gets tin, you know, cranberry juice at spring break in a frat house. I probably wouldn't get that. We didn't have fraternities and sororities at my hippie college. But it's cool to like, you get to learn more about the person when they talk about stuff. So like, That's like
one of the coffee tasters in my book. She was like training someone. I believe he was Russian, but it could have been Africa. And he kept saying, oh, this is la la berry. And so finally, she didn't want to like call him out in front of everyone who was getting trained. But finally, she was like, okay, you got to show me a picture of a la la berry. Like, I do not understand. And it literally was just what they call an American, in America, we call a blueberry, like same fruit. And like blueberry was also on the tasting wheel, you know? So it's like, to your point about Australia, like they probably have, I mean, Tim Tam is not the same, but they probably have some kind of candy that you would be speaking the same language, but we just don't even, yeah. We don't always know how to like meet each other across culture, even though we're trying to say the same thing. So it is like just a really interesting, like I said, there's only so many compounds, but across the world, we have a million different ways to describe
the same compounds, different words, different terms.
Yeah, and different cultures.
Wait, back to M. So wait, the Tootsie Roll Pop. So how did these people from another country, what did you figure out that they were talking about?
Well, it was the beer had that kind of like that the chocolate Tootsie Roll Pop where it has that kind of chocolate sweetness, but it was kind of tart. I think it was like an Oud Bruin or a Flanders Red. So it would have that sour chocolatey flavor that sometimes Oud Bruins have. And I got the flavor of Tootsie Roll. And then when I explained it to them, they all looked at me and I went, oh, I was like, okay, hold on, let me rethink about, and then I taught them about something. Same thing. They would be like, oh, this tastes like a cherry ripe. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. And then I found out it's the best candy bar in the whole wide world. It's essentially a cherry Mounds bar. It is the best. And so certain things, they describe certain foods and then, or certain flavors, and you have to pipe up and ask. You know, you have to say, excuse me, hold on a second. What is that? And then you get to learn. And that's the fun part about tasting with other people. I went to South Africa and judged the African Beer Cup, and that was the same. I would have to remember to kind of check my American food and, you know, flavor, not bias, but like, you know, check it at the door when we're talking about something, because our foods are different. You know, we all speak English and whatnot for the most part, but there were judges from Spain. There were judges from all over the world. And so when you're judging with in a worldwide group, it's really fun to, you learn so much about different flavors because they pick up stuff that you don't. And I love it. I love judging beer competitions. It's so much fun.
What, for both of you guys, what are like, what's the typical format for judging in a serious beer competition? Are there numbers? Are there the same categories, or are they different in when they're run by different people?
In beer, I mean, Em, I'll let you speak to outside the US after this, but we're actually quite lucky in beer. I didn't realize this until I started branching out to judge other things. But the BJCP is pretty much most competitions are pretty much based on the official BJCP score sheet. There's things like, I can't remember the name, FOBAB, is that what it's called in Chicago?
The Festival of Wood and Barrel Aged Beer?
Yeah, where it's a little shifted because obviously they're going to put more weight on things like barrel character. But for the most part, it's pretty consistent and judges are pretty used to seeing a score sheet like that, where when you're judging something like sake, it's just like kind of whatever the competition like wants you to talk about, they'll tell you in the intro, but there's not like scored categories. You know, beer, it's very like appearance rating out of X, smell rating out of, you know, a higher weight, or aroma, flavor, things like that, off flavor, overall match to style.
Wait, Mandy, how many different types of beverages have you judged?
I haven't always been a judge. Sometimes I was just observing, but I've been a judge for beer, sake, and then cocktail competitions, which is totally different and also doesn't have a very good score sheet, consistent score sheet. So, and do people like internationally, are you looking at something similar to the BJCP score sheet?
In Central and South America, the BJCP is incredibly popular. So they use they don't use the score sheet. There's actually a really great, I don't remember who invented it, and it's really good software. They have essentially the BJCP software. It's on a website and then you fill it out that way. And so everything is all done on computers and it's really good software. A lot of competitions in Central and South America use that. The only, I judge in Australia, and they use the Brewers Association guidelines, which is for World Beer Cup and Grand American Beer Festival. And so there's only really two that, there's been some ones I've done where they're like kind of different, but, and then there's a different way to fill out the form. Sometimes they use the BJCP, sometimes it's software, sometimes it's, I've judged in Belgium where you fill out a form and you don't talk about the beer. Sometimes you talk about it with judges, the people next to you. Sometimes you don't. The one in Belgium, everyone scored. And then you only talked about, this is what's getting the gold. This is what's getting the silver. This is what's getting the bronze. Are we cool with that?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which was actually kind of in the African Beer Cup. Actually, one of the craziest judging experiences I had was in Oregon. They record you talking. And then they give the entire recording to everyone who entered. So you know what they're talking about, the beer.
I kind of like that.
Yeah,
I like loved that too. I told the international judging, there's like a Facebook group, and they were all horrified because there's no, you can kind of figure out who's who.
Yeah.
But it also, it keeps your discussions really nice and friendly because you know you're being recorded. Not that I've ever had any competition where there's ever been like a fight or whatever, but there's no writing. When you judge some competitions, like I have a really bad right wrist. I'm an artist, so like my wrist takes a beating, and like there are days when you have to write all day and my wrist kills. And the Oregon one was, I don't have to write at all. I have to write some notes just to remember. And then they hit record and you're like, all right, let's talk about number 7527. I really liked this one. I thought it was really nice. But it was really, really transparent. The most transparent competition. And I loved every moment of it.
Yeah. And that's such good feedback for the brewers as well.
And you get to hear everyone's feedback instead of a messy sheet where you can't read anything. Like I've seen my own handwriting. A doctor once told me I had bad handwriting. So I have terrible handwriting. There is a reason my font is digitized for all my comics because my handwriting is atrocious. So yeah, no, I loved the transparency of that. And I wish that more competitions would do that.
The GABF score sheet's relatively similar to BJCP though.
Yeah. It's like it's more of you tick boxes. So like it's, instead of out of a certain number, because the BJCP's, for people who don't know, you score out of 50. So X amount goes to aroma. It's 20 for taste. I think 12 for aroma, 3 for a visual. The BA is very, it's, you know, you kind of mark like, oh, this was dark. This had good foam retention. You kind of like tick more boxes than write. The BJCP really makes you write a lot because when you're judging a homebrew competition, you need to tell people what's wrong with it and how to fix it. So you got to know when you're judging, you got to be like, wow, this was really astringent. What was your sparge temperature? Was it above 170? Because unless you're brewing a lambic, it shouldn't be that way. So it's really, oh, you got a lot of DMS. Did you cover it? Did you boil it long enough? Now you have to give people really good constructive feedback. And the BJCP really makes you think when you judge. It's not just like, oh, I liked that.
Yeah. And I think that's really a great thing about beer is that there is such a strong homebrewing culture, because what things like spirits competitions and like sake, because there's not a lot of people who came up, you know, making it as a hobby or have an organization like the BA or like the BJCP that thinks about homebrewing, it ends up being a lot more like, was this good overall? Is like the score sheet says. There's like not like these categories and like ways to think about improvement. You know, the more score sheets I saw and collected for the book, there's a whole chapter about judging by taste. And I was just like, wow, I'm so lucky that I came up through beer.
Well, I really like
it. Yeah, we're organized people.
I really like where you guys are going with this. We're just going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Support us and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. So we're talking with Mandy Naglich, the author of How to Taste, and M. Sauter of Pints and Panels. So, guys, we're having a lively conversation. I did not think about the BJCP judging and that it's meant to help homebrewers learn, and that was really cool. Thanks for going in that direction. I want to go back to Mandy's book, How to Taste. There's one chapter I'm looking at, chapter 8. 1 + 1 = 7. Put mustard in your brownie. So, Mandy, you've been talking to a lot of different people in different areas like cheese, and here you're talking to someone who's a mustard sommelier. How did you go down that path? Like, and how did you find this guy, Chef Brandon Collins?
So yeah, I think at the outset of the book, I really wanted to find like specialists in every specialty there could be. You know, I did talk to some water somms. They're not really included in the book, but like really I wanted to go as far out as I could. And so, yeah, that's how I found Brandon, who is just a mustard, truly, you know, went and trained tasting mustard seeds, grading them, learning about every kind of mustard for, I think he was totally immersed for 6 months in France. But he, works for May, which is a mustard company that specializes in Dijon. And yeah, he totally shocked me with his depth of mustard pairing knowledge and convinced me to make those mustard brownies, which I then tested on many of my unsuspecting friends and colleagues, and they all loved them, which was, you know, I thought I was being tricked just because I heard it from him and I was like, oh, I'm sure my brain is just telling me this tastes good because he told me it would. But then blind tasting people, I did plain brownies, brownies with coffee, and brownies with mustard. And many people picked the mustard brownies as their favorite. That vinegar just brightens up your chocolate a little bit. If you like a little bit of a lighter dessert, people really gravitated toward them. So I highly recommend.
I can see that, just thinking of it as an ingredient based.
Yeah, it's just two tablespoons of mustard for a batch. You know, it's nothing like, you know, they're not mustard forward brownies, but it's just that little bit of brightness.
And it's not like yellow dyed yellow mustard.
No, they did look a little bit lighter in color that I was worried that people would suspect something, but not enough.
Oh, you didn't tell people?
No, I just told them, I put them in three different colored like cupcake holders and had people do blind tasting. To pick their favorite.
Oh, wow. Well, also in that chapter, let's talk about how you talk about beer versus food. So you're using their terms here like salty, you know, umami, sweet. How are those terms different from or similar to what you would use when you talk about beer?
Yeah, I think in that chapter, I really wanted to go clinical and scientific as far as like what has actually been proven about flavor interactions. I think a lot of what we learn about pairing can be quite esoteric. And I mean, actually, Em, you're the perfect person to talk to this. Like, can you really pair office characters with a beer? Or is that more on like, you know, the ethos of the beer, which I think is a great way to pair, but not like necessarily a scientific, you know, scientifically proven pairing, which I don't think every pairing needs to be.
There's no wrong answers, really. Mm-hmm. When you're doing beer and food pairing, there are wrong answers. Like, don't drink a double IPA and a salmon, because that'll be really bad. The worst pairing I've ever had is nachos and Saison. Because spiciness fights phenols. Mm-hmm. It's not a great... You're like, oh, wow, this will be really refreshing. And you're like, oh, it's bad. But it also, that's subjective too, because certain food compounds people like, like one of the things people really like to do is pair really hot curry with really hoppy stuff because the hop bitterness will accentuate the spice. I don't like that. I don't want my food to be hoppier or more spicy. I like spicy food, but I'm not like my husband who likes to sweat when he eats. So I always pair things. I love contrasting flavors. I love salty sweet. I also like creating perfect bites. So when you're thinking of the, you know, salty, sweet, umami, sour, like how can I get all of those into one bite? I call it the complete bite. That's a good way to do, you know, that just match intensities and experiment. There's no, if you're like, I don't know if this will work, I always tell people just try it. What, you know, what's holding you? Beer is an accessible and usually pretty inexpensive thing to get. So if you're interested in beer and food pairings, just try it. You know, maybe it'll be really good. One of the most weird accidental is a New England IPA and a chocolate chip cookie is my favorite pairing because it was an accidental. I was eating a cookie and drinking a NIPA. And I was like, wow, this is really good. It tastes like one of those Terry's chocolate oranges you get at Christmas time, mm-hmm. once you break. So,
yeah, I like a chocolate chip cookie and a Brett IPA, which there aren't as many as there used to be, but
that would be good too. Chocolate chip cookie is like a really, there's so many things you can do with it. Sweets and desserts. I would love to do a beer dinner where it's just one beer style. Like, all right, everything's dark mild. And show people, hey, you know, you can do three completely different foods with the same beer or beer style and make this really wonderful dinner. You don't have to serve imperial stouts and brownies for dessert. You can do, you know, you could serve a pilsner with dessert.
Maybe we could have a brownie with mustard seeds.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly.
I like that, Mandy. So, yeah, you guys want to take a stab at a dark mild pairing, three dishes?
Oh, boy.
And what would the beer be, too? You guys mentioned a couple IPAs. Mention a couple of brands of beer as well.
They're the dark mild is, I mean, it's up and coming, but they're, who makes a dark mild? I know I work part-time at Fox Farm, and we make a dark mild called Tiddly, which is very nice. And I actually think for dessert, dark mild would be really nice with some kind of like chocolate bread pudding or a brownie, or even, if you got like a cookie sandwich, like an ice cream cookie sandwich. I usually don't go too fancy with my pairings. I go very like, what do you have in your home? Like, we're not, you know, you could, yeah, you know, we're not having beef Wellington here. Although,
I would say dark mild. I think Coney Island, I don't know if they still make one. They were making one for a little bit there that would reach you in New York, at least at Coney Island. But I also think, like you said, not too fancy. I honestly think there's not a lot of intensity to a dark mild. So almost something like shortbread cookie-ish, like a shortbread cookie ice cream sandwich. Really good. Or like speculoos, maybe add some like a... some spices in there where dark mild doesn't really have that, but nothing too intense.
And then I think for like an appetizer, something like a like chicken skewer or some kind of lower, like less intense, because even though a dark mild is dark, you have to remember the alcohol is probably 3.5%. The carbonation is usually on the lower side. A lot of them are nitrogenated. So you're not going to have any kind of what I call that mouth napkin, that scrubbing bubbles that carbonation does to lift the fat away. It's actually, was there another appetizer you could think of?
I was going to say almost honestly, I think breakfast stuff is usually pretty nice with a dark mild. Ooh, like almost like a savory French toast or something. Nothing too intense. But yeah, like you get the bready stuff going on. Obviously it's such a malt forward beer. But like you said, I mean, we're looking like tofu things, like, you know, very light intensity. Even like a vegetable can be too intense for a dark mild just because it has those strong vegetable flavors that can definitely overpower it.
I like where you guys are going with this, just because I feel that way when and you guys can tell me the science of food and beer pairings, but I always feel like I want to taste the beer and the food, and somehow together in my mouth they make something different. So like the simple shortbread, simple chicken skewer, simple savory French toast, I can see that. Is there a science of what happens in your mouth when the beer and the food go together?
It's funny, Em mentioned, I mean, and that's like the one pairing kind of rule that I give that I think is the only real rule when it comes to pairing is like you have to match intensities. If one side of the pairing is too intense, you'll never get that experience of things coming together because one will just overpower the other. You know, like a very, very strong blue cheese is going to just completely erase a dark mild from your mouth, something like that. But yeah, I don't think there's really a science. It's a lot of testing, and that's something interesting about beer. You know, for 10 different breweries making 10 different dark milds, every pairing is going to work a little bit differently because every beer is a little bit different.
You know, just talking about like where craft beer is and tasting knowledge and everything, it seems like just in 30 years that I've been in the business, you guys are at such a high level. And the resources available to you and the trainings and certificate programs are unbelievable. Does anyone ever come up to you and say, wow, I just can't believe how much knowledge you guys have?
I wish.
I give a lot of library talks. I really love doing local library talks. So I was at Cheshire, which is like Cheshire, Connecticut, which is like 20 minutes from my house. And a woman came up to me and she goes, how do you know so much about beer? And I always, my joke is I don't know anything about anything else. Like, don't ask me what like 2 + 5 is. It's probably like what, 8? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know most things, but I know a fair amount about beer. And I also want to make sure that when I give talks that beer has when you Google a lot of things in beer, a lot of times you get the wrong answer. There are a lot of websites that give a fair amount of misinformation, which really stressed me out. And that's another reason why I started Pints and Panels. And it's to make sure that when you're learning about beer and people really want to learn, they're getting the most accurate information. And then if they see something on my website, I'm always very much like, please tell me if I'm wrong. Because I, you know, want to make sure that I fix it.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's an incredible amount of misinformation out there about everything. But to your point, I think people shouldn't be afraid, as long as they do it kindly and with sources, to point out when things are wrong, because generally everyone just wants correct information out there.
You know, Mandy, I just want to tell you how really cool this book is. It's not what I expected. And that's what I mean. Like, I just feel like I was just thinking back to Garrett Oliver's first book, which I'm blanking on the title, where he did beer and food pairings.
And Brewmaster's Table.
And my lifetime.
It's almost as if Em and I have both.
Yeah, of course you know it. And I was, when you mentioned, you said blue cheese, and I thought Garrett Oliver, because there's one fallback whenever we have a conversation about beer and food pairings. The only thing I can ever remember is, well, in Garrett Oliver's book, he had like a good barley wine with a good Stilton blue cheese. And so going back to,
he loves Stilton.
You gotta love it, but it's like going back to that book.
I love Stilton.
Like, it's when that book came out, that was like the book of beer and food pairing and recipes in my world. So building on, you know, whatever, the backs of our founders or whatever. I mean, are you guys like amazed just how far things have come, or do you feel like that the Garrett's book has a lot of information? I mean, is that the only book I need to have for beer and food pairing? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at, is how far can we go with this?
I think Em's Instagram account. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in Garrett's book. He does lean, like you said, Stilton. He leans a bit fancy, I would say, you know. Foie gras is not always the first thing you think about pairing with something like beer.
He does love duck. He's a big duck.
He does love fancy.
Exactly.
It's a fancy book. It's a great book, though.
Yeah, it's a great way to elevate beer for sure. But maybe not every day. I can't be eating duck all the time.
I would eat duck all the time if I could, but I don't. But yeah, no, it's beer pairings are all about, again, experimentation. Yeah, I have a beer and food pairing section of my second book, Hooray for Craft Beer, that's on the smaller side, but that teaches you about matching intensities, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner pairings, you know, certain stuff. And yeah, I've done a ton of different pairings of beer. I just did beer and fancy food, actually, last week, because I think I saw a copy of Brewmaster's Table in my living room, and I was like, fancy food. But I came up with my own.
So what were your fancy food pairings?
There was one of the Garrett's big ones that is really is a lobster and oud bruin.
I never would have thought of that. Like,
I know. And it's, to me, that actually is, I think I've tried it out before, because I must have. I'm not a big lobster in the shell. I don't want eyes looking at me when I eat something. So, but I must have tried it with like a lobster tail or whatnot. But that's one of his big pairings. I did like beef, king crab legs and whipped beer. I'm trying to think of what it was, like beef Wellington. There was, what else was there? I don't even remember. This is what happens when you post.
I was going to say, I remember the beef Wellington one. So I was like, it's hard to draw beef Wellington because it's not, you know, always apparent from the outside what it is. I can tell.
I tried. Yeah, they're like Kobe beef. Peking duck and Maibach was the one that I was like, out of all of those, I want that. Or foie gras and quad caviar and goza. So there, yeah, truffle, risotto, and saison.
I got to say, I'm a caviar and Belgian golden strong girl. Ooh. But we got to try. We'll try.
I wanted salt, more salt with my caviar. Extra little salt balls with goza just sounded nice. And gozas were like very refreshing and clean. And yeah.
Wow. You guys, this is, I to our listeners out there, you got to get Mandy Naglitz's How to Taste book. You got to definitely keep up with all the M. Sauter's books. And good last question. Each of you are going to ask the other one question and then we'll close out. Can be about anything.
Mandy, what events are you? What's the full gamut of where people can see you? Did you already talk about that? But I want you to talk about it again so people don't forget.
I was going to say what we should say is just everyone who's close by, make the trek up to RJ Julia and see us together on July 12th.
Yeah, in Middletown at 5 p.m.
I'm lucky to have a team that's maintaining the book events part of my website, but I know it's all East Coast for now until August, and then West Coast will be hitting that in September. LA, Seattle, Portland.
What day is it in Middletown, Connecticut?
July 12th at 5 p.m. Wow. I think it's a Wednesday.
That's going to be happening.
Beer and chocolate.
And then Mandy, do you have a question for
what was the most difficult pairing request you've had?
Oh gosh. A lot of them, I guess for infographics, it's stuff I've never watched before. So I have to I've never watched Secession. So people are like, Secession characters. And I was like, wow, that'd be really cool. I've never seen that show. but that's a fun way to like lean on people who are popular, who like that stuff. And then I'm trying to think about like beer and foods. I don't know. I had a really interesting pairing with I went to a sausage dinner with Josh Bernstein for his second edition of his book, and they did a bunch of different pairings with sausages, and that was really cool. And there was a monkfish sausage, which was unique.
Yeah, I was going to say the texture.
The texture was really, it was very spongy. It was the spongiest sausage I've ever eaten. But the beers that they had pairing with them were really cool. It was just, it's fun to, you know, think about something like a sausage and then elevate it and then pair a beer with it. So
that's really cool. You guys have been great. And a big shout out again, Mandy Naglitz, How to Taste. And just on the back, it says, I mean, I actually first might have interviewed you when you won the National Homebrew Competition gold medal. I knew that you were an advanced Cicerone, did not know you were a certified cider professional. And you've also
the first time I won or the second time I got a gold.
I don't know. I don't know if it's first or second. I can't keep up with you. And she's also earned the certificate of WSET Level 1 Spirit. So,
well, that's the galley of the book because I finished the full diploma on spirits now. I was like, I got to get this done before the book comes out. So
you're a rock star. You're really like every time I talk to you, you're at the next level. And this book is going to be one of my favorite reads. And I'm definitely going to keep up with M. Sauter's books too. I have the Hooray, and I have to get that cover too. So you guys are awesome. Just want to say thank you so much, Mandy. Yeah. Thank you so much, M. Big shout out to Matt Patterson, our engineer tonight. I'm Jimmy Carboni, and we'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.